Confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
Your body's filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not. Your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. Your neurobiological system is telling it to run. But your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. And do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
Listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's time to slip back the curtains and savor the beauty of this fine Sunday morning. Settle down on the chaise lawn with a warming mug of happy hellos and a plateful of wondrous wishes as we enjoy a metaphorical dive into the pool of poetic peregrinations and gallivanting geekery. Welcome to the weird wonder that is Willow's Weekend World.
Good morning and welcome from a beautiful United Kingdom. My name is Willow Andreas and also known as Sorry Sunflower in the Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com chat room. And this is the Sunday, the 3rd of July, 2022 edition of this weird old show of mine, Willow's Weekend World. And before I get started with telling you what's happening on today's show, I just want to say a big, big thank you to Gerbear was the, he did the overnights over on, I'm not sure what time he finished. But he did the overnights. I think actually there was, I think Mitchell was playing something. Yeah, Mitchell was playing something, wasn't he, for the past couple of hours on Studio A. But again, a big, big thank you to all the hosts here for everything they all do. It's truly appreciated indeed. And to the producers and moderators who sometimes have the few challenges to face, but they face those challenges generally with smiles on their faces. A big, big thank you to them as well as huge outpourings of gratitude and lots of good things, good, wonderful wishes to the team that I'm humbled and honoured to be a part of. That is the management team. A team that bends over backwards and beyond to ensure that this station remains on air for as close to 24 hours per day or daily, 24/7 as we can get it, which is most of the time. Excuse me, I'm feeling a little bit out of it today, folks, but I'll do the best I can. And the team bends over backwards and beyond, folks. As I say, in sickness and in health applies to this, believe me. Again, it's a big, big thank you to the team for everything they all do. It's truly appreciated indeed. And also to huge outpourings of gratitude and lots of love and hugs and kisses to Liz Ringley, who continues to represent so, so much to the station, and to the individual whose prescience, whose vision, whose drive convinced him he needed to construct this vessel for free speech. Over 11 and a half years ago now, took its maiden journey on New Year's Day 2011, And yeah, in those 11 and a half years, the station has become a global phenomenon with its reach totally around the world, and has become a global family, a family of like-minded souls, kindred spirits, souls who have gravitated towards each other and indeed been reunited with each other as a result of the amazing gift of Michael Ringley, Nighthawk, who is missed every single day. A big, big thank you to Hawk. And also, I'm looking at his photographs to say this now. Huge outpourings of gratitude and lots of love and hugs and kisses to my late other half, Briarios, who continues to represent so, so much of my life and always, always will. Thank you very, very much indeed, my love. And also, huge outpourings of gratitude and lots of love and hugs and kisses to some very, very special loved ones in my life. They know exactly who they are. They know exactly who they are. And to the musician, yeah, bit rough. Bit rough indeed. And to someone else who I know is listening, let's just keep holding hands. That's the best thing we can do. It's the only thing we can do. And last but not least, folks, huge outpourings of gratitude and lots of love and hugs and kisses to you amazing listeners. We do this for you. We wouldn't be able to do this without you either, folks. It's a totally symbiotic relationship. It's your kindness, your love, your support, your generosity that enables us to continue providing you with such a wide variety of shows hosted by amazing individuals from all around the world on a close to 24/7 basis. We don't have any commercials here. The only promotions we have here at the station is to do with the station itself, the station business and station shows. And yeah, it's all, and station information as well. And your kindness, your love, your generosity and support enables us to provide you with the archives for free as well. We don't take your support for granted, folks. We know just how challenging these times are for so, so many right now. We do not take your support for granted. We truly don't. We truly appreciate everything you do for us. Listeners, supporters alike, you are all very, very precious to us. Again, a big, big thank you to you all. And I hope that you can feel those waves of gratitude enveloping you as I speak. A big, big thank you to you all indeed. As I just mentioned, we are entirely listener-supported, folks. If you'd like to help us out and you're not sure how, what I recommend you do is you visit our website, which you can reach using one of two URLs. It's either www.revolution.radio, that's www.revolution.radio, or www.freedomslips.com. I'll repeat that as well, www.freedomslips.com. Either or takes you to the exact same location. And the details that you require, I'm sorry, I've just been completely blindsided. Excuse me a minute. I'm just going to get myself back on track. Ooh, this could be a rough one today, folks. I'm trying to get through it. Come on. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it. The station, as I say, you'll arrive upon this amazing website of ours, which has been established and lovingly maintained by the fantastic Monster 383. So when you see him in the chat room, folks, say a big, big thank you to him, because he does an absolutely sterling job here at the station. He doesn't say very much, but he is a tour de force, and that's Monster 383. Big, big thank you to him. And the places you need to explore are to be found on the nav bar. The nav bar, of course, is a static bar of options, which can be found at the top of the homepage. Stays there at the top as you're scrolling down. Doesn't go anywhere. But if you want to go and check something else out, but you don't want to lose your place on the nav, on the homepage, then you don't have to worry about that, folks. Don't worry about it whatsoever, because you can just click on the option you wish to go to and check out, and that will open up in a new tab for you. You won't lose your place on the homepage. So don't worry about that. The store, we are looking into new options for the store because, of course, we no longer have our Zazzle store. No ideas what happened, but we are exploring new options for the store. We'll let you know what those options are as soon as we have all the details available. What we suggest you check, though, is the donations option, which details all the methods bar one at the moment of supporting the station. We've got Patreon, we've got Donor Box, we've got Direct Payment North America Only. All three have monthly support options available for them. You need to be a patron in order to do so on Patreon, by the way. And again, a big, big thank you to our patrons. I'm blowing you kisses. Hope you can hear them. And I hope you receive them. A big, big thank you to you all. And you can become a patron either by clicking on this option here on the donations page or heading back to our homepage and finding it sitting pretty in pink near the top of it. We've got Donor Box, which is the alternative to PayPal. It's international in scope. It's easy to use. And again, you can set up something for regular monthly support or you can use it whenever you are able to use it. Direct Payment North America only applies if you happen to live in the US or Canada and have a credit or debit card. Same options available there as with Donor Box. We accept three different types of cryptocurrency support, folks. They are Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash. I'll repeat those. Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash. There are QR codes on the screen. You point your devices at them and you do your thing. That is what I recommend. Now, I can't tell you any more than that, folks. Got no idea. And last but not least are the snail mail options, folks. Yet we still accept checks or money orders, and they are to be made payable to Revolution Radio. That's two separate words. Revolution spelled R-E-V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N. That's R-E-V-O-L-U-T-I-O-N. And radio is spelled R-A-D-I-O. And I'll repeat that as well. It's R-A-D-I-O. And once they are completed, they are to be mailed to the wonderful lady horse, Terry Ackerman. Terry spelled T-E-R-R-Y. I'll repeat that. T-E-R-R-Y. And Ackerman is spelled A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. I'll repeat that as well. It's A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. And the mailing address is 1793. That's 1793 North Eden. Eden spelled E-D-O-N Road. And that's Allen, A-L-L-E-N, Michigan, M-I. 49227. So checks or money orders made payable to Revolution Radio are then to be mailed to the wonderful lady horse Terry Ackerman at 1793 North Eden Road, and that's Allen, Michigan, 49227. Those details are also found on the main homepage at the bottom of the page, and you can also advertise on the station's website as well, folks. If you've got a product or company you'd like to advertise, cost is an issue. You can advertise on our website, but we do get a lot of visitors, folks. I mean, when the account, before the count went down and even before the other one did, I mean, that one was heading towards 600,000, the previous one. And this one was heading towards 500,000. And I'm guessing we have accumulated now well over 1 million views, if not heading towards 2 million views on the website. So for $25 a month, advertising on here gets you good coverage. And for further details, you need to contact the station's general manager, Amad Painter, using the following email address, which is themadpainter13@yahoo.com. That's themadpainter13@yahoo.com. I'll spell out that first segment for you. It's themadpainter13. And I'll repeat that. It's themadpainter13@yahoo.com, all lowercase in format, by the way. Don't forget we've got dedicated call to listen numbers for both studios, folks. The numbers you just call, you just listen. That's all you have to do. You don't have to participate. You don't have to speak, but we do recommend heartily that you contact your cell phone or landline service providers to speak to them about costs, because there are costs involved with calling these numbers. Strongly recommend you do that. Call them. Check first. Once you're happy with what you've been told, the dedicated call to listen number for Studio A is 518-906-1839. I'll repeat that. It's 518-906-1839. And the dedicated call to listen number for Studio B is 518-906-1859. So I'll repeat that. It's 518-906-1859. Don't forget to call to check those costs first, though. your cell phone and landline service providers. And last but not least, folks, are the archives. They're free to access, will be for the foreseeable. You can reach the archives either by clicking on the archives option, which is third along in the nav bar, or going direct to its URL, which is www.revolutionradioarchives.com. That's www.revolutionradioarchives.com. Either or gets you to the exact same location, and the details you need to access the wonders that await you within are the username and the password, both of which are lowercase and case sensitive in format. The username is Rev Radio. That's Rev Radio. I'll spell that for you. It's R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O. I'll repeat that. It's R-E-V-R-A-D-I-O. And the password is ROCKS! Exclamation mark. That's ROCKS! Exclamation mark. I'll spell that for you. It's R-O-C-K-S! Exclamation mark. And I'll repeat that. It's R-O-C-K-S! Exclamation mark. Don't forget that exclamation mark, folks, because without it, you won't get in. Believe me, I omitted it. I didn't get in. I speak from harsh experience. But again, a big, big thank you to everyone for your continued support. We are truly grateful indeed. Thank you. I'm just going to take a sip of tea. Hold on a minute. That's a bit better. Boy. Anyway, carry on. Come on. You can do this. You can do it. Come on. Come on, girl. Right, so what's happening on today's show? Well, I'm going to wander into the chat room shortly to say a big hello to everybody in there and make sure everybody's okay. And then it's the dedicated Sunday morning geek out today, folks. So it's focusing on the one subject or individual. It's individual in this case. And I suppose you could also say subject, I suppose. And Sunday Morning Geek House is journeying to the worlds of 20th and 21st century electronic music for this one, to focus on one of its most influential of figures, and indeed he is. Not sure if you've heard of him across the pond. Not really sure. He was born in Limerick in Ireland in August 1971 to Welsh parents, and the family relocated to Cornwall in England during his early childhood. He became interested in music at a very young age, experimenting with different sounds using the family piano, disassembled tape machines, and a Sinclair ZX81. Very, very similar, actually, to Vangelis in many regards. And in fact, I was having this conversation with a friend on Friday about the similarities between Vangelis, this individual, and Liam Howlett of The Prodigy. They just had family pianos, and they started experimenting with different sounds using that instrument, and it's just a lot of similarities. So he acquired his first synthesizer at the age of 12 and started developing his own techniques from there on in. He began to compose music at the age of 14, presciently creating music of a style that became similar, or was similar to what emerged actually during the upcoming acid house genre. So he is predating. It was basically he was creating that kind of music in the mid 80s, and it didn't become that kind of music wasn't really publicly sort of played until the late 80s. Hope that makes sense. He became part of the Cornish Free Party scene during the late 1980s and secured a regular DJ slot at the Bogey nightclub in Crantock, where he met music producers Tom Middleton and Grant Wilson Claridge. He signed to Middleton's Mighty Falls Records label and, with Wilson Claridge, co-founded Reflex Records in 1991. His first EP release, Analog Bubble Bath, was released on Mighty Falls in September 1991, which received heavy airplay on the London-based radio station Kiss FM. The EP soon gained traction in the dance music scene and came to the attention of R&S Records head Renat van der Papelier. The two worked through the musician's cassettes of music from previous years, some of which went to form the basis of his first album, Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92, which I've listened to many a time. Very good album, actually. The second album is a bit different, but anyway, I'll get to that in a minute. He moved to London during the earliest days of the 1990s to pursue electronic studies at the former Kingston Polytechnic, and also started performing regularly at various techno events in the capital. The aforementioned and extensively critically acclaimed Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92 was released on Apollo Records in November 1992, and its release is considered a watershed moment in the ambient music scene. He continued to release EPs and tracks, and in 1993 began to tour extensively, both in a solo capacity and in support of more established acts such as The Orb. A change of style began to emerge in 1994 selected Ambient Works Volume 2, a style which coalesced on various releases over the coming years. 1997 saw the release of what is arguably his most famous track, and his video as well, the accompanying video certainly, the death metal parodying Come to Daddy. I think Russell T. Davis or Rusty D also got the idea, some of the inspirations for The End of Time Part 2 from that video, I'm telling you that much. He has continued releasing thought-provoking and challenging music well into the 21st century, including 2001's experimental double album Drux and the 2018 EP Collapse. Highly regarded by many of his co-luminaries in the music world, including Radiohead's Tom York and Red Hot Chili Peppers' John Frusciante, he has been the recipient of many awards over the course of his 30-plus years career. His name is Richard D. James. He is better known, though, as the Aphex Twin. Enjoying a selection of articles exploring his earliest days, the groundbreaking nature of his works, his thoughts on Radiohead, a review of a typical Aphex Twin gig, an exploration of 10 of the most unusual myths attributed to the artist, and concluding with 20 of his most powerful tracks as rated by The Guardian's Geeta Dayal. If there's any time for anything from the Poetry Corner, I'll have a look. But I don't know. I'm not going to promise anything at this point. I'm hoping to get through the show. So, anyway, folks, I'm going to wander into the chat room now and say a big hello to everybody in the chat room. Make sure everybody is okay. Let's see who is in. I don't know who's in the other one. We'll start the Chatsy chat room first, which, as just a reminder, folks, that the Chatsy chat room will be phased out as of the 12th of August. So we've got about 7 weeks left, but the Chatsy chat room is going to be phased out permanently, come 12th of August. And we are migrating across lock, stock and barrel to the Elemental Matrix chat room, which has got some rather fascinating features. I suggest you go and check it out. Let's see who's in. We've got the wonderful Lady Horse in the chat room. She's one of our wonderful managers here, folks. She's the station treasurer and she's the station's moderator and manager as well. And another amazing manager is in. That's Monster 383. Ireland One is in as well as Nezomania, one of our fabulous hosts. The lovely Lizzie is in as Meow. She has two shows here at the station. She's on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern with Coffee Time with Lizzie, and she's also on, well, she's going to be on after me today at 11 a.m. Eastern with the Spirit Talk with Lizzie. Another amazing manager is in, that's Mitchell. Mitchell, of course, is the host of the station's breakfast show Revolution in the Morning, which is on weekday mornings on Studio A. So that's Monday to Friday, 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern. He also has a show on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, also on Studio A, which is the Trump Assassination Files show. And he produces a number of shows as well. He's on over the other side of the studio wall at the moment. WH Devo is in as well as Amiga Logos. Telstar is in as well as Batman. Another amazing manager is in. That's Pat Rabbit. Patrick, of course, is the host of Not for Public Consumption, which is on this studio on Thursdays at midday Eastern. Wally is in as well as Laura Bella. Comet is in as well as some weird person by the name of Surrey Sunflower. The voice of the overnights at the weekend and sometimes during the week as well. Gerber is in the chat room as well as Popsicle Toes. NetEffect is in as well as Dirt. Mace139 is in as well as Not Much To It. Dirt Engineer is in as well as In the Kitchen. And another amazing manager is in. That's the Right Reverend Dr. Mr. Rowe, who has three offerings on Studio A. He's on a bit later today at 5 p.m. Eastern with the Row Lounge. 2 4 p.m. offerings. Mondays is Crypto Corner. Tuesdays is Rose Corner. And he's also on this studio on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern with Reality Extraction. But he pops up anywhere, does Roe? You never know where he's going to end up. And Malaya is in as well as the station's wonderful GM, AMAD. And Painter, of course, is the host of the two shows on Studio A. He'll be on a bit later today. Well, not that far away, actually. It's 11 a.m. Eastern. With a mad look at reality, and he also rounds off Monday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern with Open Canvas. Let's see who else has been in. Jim Jones has been in as well as Valerie, and the Hack has been in as well. Let's see who else is in the chat room. Let's see who else is in the other chat room. I don't know who's in the other chat room. I don't think there's anybody. It's just me in my one at the moment, which I'm perfectly fine with. I'm not bothered. I just want to get through the show. So come and join us in the chat rooms, either or, if you want to, folks. It's entirely up to you, but you're more than welcome to. So, geeking out today, folks. Big focused geek out on heading back to the world of 20th and 21st century electronic music to focus on one of its most influential figures, and indeed one of my my knowledge of Richard D. James's works aren't as extensive as, say, my knowledge of Depeche Mode's works, or Duran Duran's for that matter, although I have to say Depeche Mode is the one that I know more about. But I know enough of his stuff, and he's an interesting artist. I do indeed highly rate selected ambient works 85 to 92, and indeed I may well just listen to it again a bit later today. But he's weird and he's wonderful in my view, and I like weird and wonderful. I've got a number of articles up about Richard D. James. Again, I don't know if you've heard. I mean, the Aussie friends, certainly the Australian or Australasian friends will certainly have heard of him, I'm sure. But he has performed in the US. But I've got a number of articles up about Richard D. James, who is better known as the Aphex Twin. And what I'll do is I'll start with his Wikipedia. The opening paragraphs from his Wikipedia article, just to get you into the flow. And then there's a number of articles I have, as I've mentioned, which I'm going to share. One of the first one, which is from his earliest days. Looking at another article, which is exploring how he changed the face of music. In many respects, particularly ambient music. Also his views on Radiohead as well. Because, of course, Thom Yorke has actually stated it. He's been a big fan of the Aphex Twin. And indeed, it was listening to the Aphex Twin's music, I understand, that led to the development of Kid A from Radiohead. Going to also have a look at a review of one of his concerts, just to give you the feel of what it is like going to an Aphex Twin gig. I would like to go to an Aphex Twin gig. I would love to. It would be great to see. I'd love to see it. Then there's going to be another article, which is about 10 strange myths and the truth behind them, because he's a bit of an interesting character. Is Richard D. James. And then finally, we're going to conclude with a review ranking of 20 of his best tracks, as rated by Geeta Dayal of The Guardian. So I've got a fair bit to get through. So Richard David James was born on 18th of August 1971. He's better known as the Aphex Twin and less prominently as AFX. He's an Irish-born British musician, composer and DJ. He's best known for his idiosyncratic work in electronic styles such as techno, ambient and jungle. Music journalist from publications including Mixmag, The New York Times, NME, Fact, Clash and The Guardian have called James one of the most influential or important artists in contemporary electronic music. Raised in Cornwall, James began DJing at free parties and clubs in the area in the late 1980s and later at venues around the West Country. His debut EP, Analog Bubble Bath, was released in 1991 on Mighty Force Records. It brought James acclaim and a cult following. He began to perform at techno clubs and raves across the UK and continental Europe. He co-founded the independent label Reflex Records the same year. 1991, yeah. So James's 1992 debut album, Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92, was released by Belgian label Apollo, gathered wider critical and popular appreciation. That year, he also appeared on the influential Warp Records compilation Artificial Intelligence. He signed to Warp the following year and subsequently released charting albums such as I Care Because You Do from 1995 and Richard D. James' album from 1996, as well as top 40 singles On from 1993, Come to Daddy from 1997, and Window Licker from 1999. With music videos directed by Chris Cunningham, Come to Daddy and Window Licker brought James significantly wider international attention. The video to Come to Daddy is a real mind trip, by the way, folks. I mean, if you've never seen it, I recommend you watch it on YouTube, and it's just, whoa. Anyway, after releasing Drux in 2001, James spent several years releasing music on his own Reflex label, including the 2005 Analog EP series and a pair of 2007 releases under the alias The Tuss, which apparently is Cornish for it's a Cornish Cornish slang for something, which is yeah. So that's all I'm going to say. Apparently, in 2014, he made it available a previously unreleased 1994 LP as Caustic Window. He returned later that year with the album Syro, which won the Grammy Award for Best Dance Electronic Album. He has since released charting EPs including Cheetah from 2016 and Collapse from 2018. So he's a bit of a busy boy. So I'll just share those in the chat room. Both. There we go. Done. And the first article is from musicradar.com. It was published on July the 8th last year, but it's a reprint of a classic interview with the Aphex Twin. And it was from 1993. So his earliest days. And it's headlined, "I hate the idea of using other people's equipment. I just got a bit obsessed, I suppose." So, yeah, it's originally, I think it was on Future Music. So back in 1993, Richard James's techno and ambient electro music was already being raved about. And Future Music's Dave Robinson was on the case. So it's Dave Robinson who wrote this. Speed restrictions, who needs them? In January 1992, the Aphex Twin showed the techno world that his frenetic didgeridoo could smash the 150 BPM barrier effortlessly and still keep the punters dancing. It's taken a few months for his legend to spread, but now Richard James, a.k.a. the Aphex Twin, a.k.a. Polygon Window, a.k.a. AFX, a.k.a. God knows how many other pseudonyms he's got, is being lauded and applauded everywhere. Jesus Jones seemed to talk about him in every interview they do. Curve played didgeridoo before their gigs. We've even mentioned him in three out of the first five issues of Future Music. His two recently released albums, Surfing on Sine Waves under the name Polygon Window and Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92 as The Twin, have shown that he's not just a speed terrorist. He's capable of producing music that's electronic, but always varied, fluid and thoughtful. The general agreement is that Richard and his music are something different in a scene where bands and tracks burn brightly for a few weeks and are then forgotten. With Richard's rising reputation have come the stories. Yes, he does build or modify nearly all his gear. Yes, he started doing it when he was 12. And yes, he comes from the depths of Cornwall. In 85 and 86, he was writing a style of music that would emerge 2 years later as Acid House. Pretty much a hint of genius in a guy who claims that, at the time, nothing but mainstream music was available to him. "I didn't have any equipment when I started," Richard recalls. "I used to make tape loops and put them on ghetto blaster motors or reel-to-reels that I could get for £5 from junk shops. I did a hell of a lot with those, like creating finished collages of sound that I'd then make, say, 5 copies of. I'd sync up all the motors and play the tapes back, fluctuating the tape speed to create effects like blanging, chorus and phase shifting. I bought a Roland 100M monosynth when I was 13. It's like an SH-101, but I got really pissed off with it. I started customizing my keyboards, then changing the components. When we started secondary school, there was an electronic course, so music and electronics went hand in hand. Plus the fact that I didn't have any money. If I wanted to get anything different, I had to change what I had or make something. Through customizing the stuff, I got a working knowledge of the keyboards and the circuitry. I started building little modules, and that's gone on to building whole circuits. I never made these from magazines. I like to do it myself. I just made filters and oscillators and stuff. Excuse me. The biggest thing I built was a sampler. It took about a year as a college project. Teachers didn't know what a sampler was, so it was all down to me. It worked for about 8 weeks and then packed up. Half the time it didn't sample. It just made really good noises. Mad stuff. So I've got a massive library of sounds from that. When it came to getting an app together, I realised that making the stuff and coming up with the sounds that no one else could was my main asset, so I decided to keep working on it. It's immediately apparent that Richard is a determined bloke. But his sense of purpose, impatience even, has now taken him to a point where he can practically do what he likes. He's inundated with offers of remixing, and several major record labels want to talk contracts. And all this without a top 40 single, too. The Aphex Twin is happy to talk about his music and his machines, but he's loath to reveal his creations to the world in order to keep up some sense of mystery about his methods. Most of his kit resides in the Reflex studio in Cornwall, but he's currently, this is from 1993, remember, but he's currently working and mastering in London, where his gear includes kits such as a Roland TB-303, a DX7, an old Korg analog sequencer, an Atari ST and monitor, plus the usual CD player, DAT machine, and amplifier. But there are a lot of disfigured synths, open circuits and devices decorated with copious helpings of wire and patch leads. Very little survives without being butchered to some degree. The only keyboard I haven't changed is the Korg MS-20. I've got three of those, says Richard. It's a mad keyboard. It's got a range of sounds, great range of sounds, and I like it the way it is. The SH-101 certainly didn't survive the surgeon's screwdriver. Doesn't look like a 101 anymore. I use the sliders, but for different things, Richard explains. This is typical of how he works. If he hasn't got a sound, he'll build something to make it using whatever is available. A lot of things I make don't respond over a keyboard range. They'll make one sound, which I'll sample. Some stuff I control with triggers and control voltages. I put a lot of control on these so I can alter the sound while they're being triggered. I used to spend all my time building the stuff, but now I haven't built anything for ages, he continues. A lot of my stuff breaks down, so at the moment I'm just a technician repairing things I've built over the years. I don't need to make anything new now. I've got everything I need. I know I won't get bored with the things I've got for years to come. It could be 5 years before I build anything, apart from the odd little thing to fill a gap. I've got too many possibilities to mess around with. To ensure that these possibilities are fully explored, Richard has come to a decision over the last few months. To use only his own inventions in his music making, and to leave conventional synths and drum machines alone. I really hate the idea of using other people's equipment. I've just got a bit obsessed, I suppose, he admits. I don't want to use pre-programmed drum sounds. I've used modified Roland TR-808 sounds on ambient works, but that's because the tracks are around 4 to 5 years old. And the Polygon Window tracks use updated 808 sounds because the original recording quality is so abysmal. I'm surprised the ambient stuff came out as well as it did. Someone phoned up to ask how we got the quality so good. I thought, what are they talking about? It's shit. The recordings do seem a tad rough in places on the Ambient Works album, as though they were recorded on just a 4-track at home. But the truth is even stranger. Everything was originally mastered on standard tape on a hi-fi cassette deck. I've only had a dat for just over a year, Richard reveals. And considering that the tracks were selected by his friends in Cornwall, who were listening to the tapes on car stereos and Walkmans, some of those masters have seen the wear of around 50 cassette players, so he reckons. With the first track, Exile on Ambient Works, the tape had chewed in about 7 places. Good old days. Richard resisted the temptation to edit the tracks for the album. Not much has been EQ'd. It would have been easy to edit out the glitches digitally, but it's a retrospective look, and the tape munching was all part of the stuff I was doing, so I've left it in. The sampler, a Casio FZ10 with custom filters tacked on, is used on a surprising 80% of Richard's tracks. Samples either come from homemade electronic sounds or from an afternoon spent in a scrapyard with beaters and hammers. Quoth, on Surfing on Sine Waves, uses such rattling found sounds. In keeping with his ideals, Richard is opposed to using samples from others, though Julie Andrews and Gene Wilder do make the occasional appearance. I don't sample records I buy, he says, which must be difficult to resist when you're buying about several dozen techno records each fortnight. That's not the way I work. I mean, a lot of the BBC sci-fi sound effects records are wicked. Some of them are like ambient tracks. I don't know whether they realised they were writing music or just doing it for people in theatres. I like to listen to it, but I won't sample it. I generally only sample sounds I've made. I've got 3 DATs worth of breaks that I've made over the years. The FZ10 is a MIDI sampler, so maybe synth communication is not all triggers and CVs then. Some of the old stuff is converted or triggered. I've bought a few MIDI to CV converters. Some are good and some not so good. I've never made my own. I've messed around with ones I've bought. I like some of the converters, but I think they're a bit expensive for what they do because they're quite easy to make. I don't think they've put enough controls on them for things like cutoff frequencies. There's far more sequencing in Richard's work than the sometimes improvisatory style suggests too. Improvisatory. It's 99% sequenced, he says. Strings I'll play, but everything else has to be accurate. Music that's out of time does my head in. I used to write my own sequencing programs on the Spectrum, that's the Sinclair Spectrum, believe it or not. I then used the Atari stuff live, but it kept overheating and crashing. So I built another sequencer. I write something on the ST and transfer the data down to my sequencer for live work. I really like the Korg analog sequencers because you can control every note and change all the frequencies. It's a different approach. So with all these wonderful toys at his disposal, how does he compose? Excuse me a minute. Sorry about that. Sometimes I have a plan that I've got to get out from start to finish. Other times I've got no preset ideas. I just sit down in front of the stuff and see what happens. I never keep sounds on disc, he adds, dropping another bombshell. This does record companies' heads in because they like you to remix, but I just don't like to do it. Sometimes I might spend 3 or 4 days to get the sounds together, then do a track with them. Next time I work on something, if I have a wicked idea for a melody and I'm feeling lazy, it would be too easy to use a disc of drums that I've used before. That's why I don't save anything, because I like everything to be different. Remixing is something the Aphex Twin is keen on, and he reckons he can turn his hand to most things remixable. I don't have to like the band or the music to remix something. I get more satisfaction making something good out of something that's shit. If something is good in the first place, it's not too hard to make it as good. I prefer to work on something I don't like and then turn it into something I do. It's more fun that way. I listen to the track and pick out the bits I like, then get the engineer to put it down on DAT. Originally, remixing meant just making it 10 seconds longer or adding a different drum track. But now you have to rewrite, which is exactly what I want. But Richard sees another cause begging for his talents. I want to get into film scoring. Soundtracks have been stuck in a groove for so long. I think people are pissed off with bad filter sounds in scary films and Tangerine Dream type soundtracks. What they lacked was a beat, which is where my new stuff comes in. Asked if he's heard of the soundtracks of John Carpenter, Richard answers, like most things, it's not essential for me to know what other people do. I know what I want to do. And let nothing get in his way. So yeah, this originally appeared in Future Music in 1993. So obviously equipment has changed a little bit since then. But I have to say I was a little bit smiley. When I was, hiya Ireland. Yeah, a little bit smiley when I was reading some of that, especially about chewed up tapes. Yes, many a time my first car had a tape deck and it was the time spent sort of untangling much played cassettes from the... Oh, it was great fun. Good old days. Good old days in that regard. The next article is from The Independent. And it's authored by Ed Power. It was posted up on Friday the 11th of February this year. And it's headlined, "This is not music. 30 years of Aphex Twin selected ambient works." And the article, as Ed Power it says here, explores how Cornish Enigma Richard James changed the future of music with an inscrutable 13-track masterpiece, rather, and went on to become the Demon Prince of electronica, leaving fans to search for hidden codes and any sign of the artist himself. He's very good at being rather evasive, is Richard D. James, about himself. So on 24th of April 1993, graphic designer Paul Nicholson was standing on stage at Osmo's, a Stygian and hazily remembered Paris club, wearing nothing but a pair of oversized skater shorts and a feral scowl. He was accompanied by his pal Richard, who was using a beige personal computer and a tangle of wires and keyboards to trigger oscillations of synthesized chaos. The audience gawked at the two young Englishmen, with their stringy hair and intense gazes. The mood was a mix of anger and befuddlement. It was a strange night. At that time, the French taste was more towards a funk style of house, recalls Nicholson. Even before we played the gig, there were members of the sound crew already giving Richard a hard time. The attitude of "this is not music." So when the concert actually happened, Richard ramped up the noise. Richard was Richard David James, the pioneering electronica producer and iconoclast known as Aphex Twin. And Nicholson was designer of the Aphex Twin A logo that famously adorned James's landmark album, Selected Ambient Works, 85 to 92, which turned 30 in February of this year. He also briefly held the unofficial position of Aphex Twin on stage dancer, which is how he found himself in Paris with his shirt off, staring down a room of discommoded French clubbers. "Even before we did the gig, we were kind of getting pissed off with the attitude of the people there," says Nicholson from his design studio in London. "It was the kind of music where I wasn't going to be in any way friendly, or mood rather. My stance was quite aggressive." As Nicholson says, there was a lot of aggression in Aphex Twin's music that evening too, the drill-bit grooves colliding with torrents of pure noise. Yet this was merely one side of James's artistic persona. 12 months previously, with Selected Ambient Works, he'd demonstrated a far subtler touch. With its ghostly samples of the human voice and disembodied tempos, the 13-track masterpiece was both accessible and inscrutable. Arriving at the height of a house explosion, Selected Ambient Works showed electronic music could be more than ribcage-rattling beats and hands-in-the-air euphoria. It was also the work of a natural-born outsider, who delighted in wrong-footing his audience by putting out music under a variety of pseudonyms, including AFX, Polygon Window, and Blue Calcs. James was a self-taught musician from the Cornish town of Redruth, population 14,000. While at school he had created his own instruments out of gutted ZX Spectrum computers and whatever spare parts were to hand. Those bedroom composer horizons had expanded in his late teens when he discovered clubbing culture. with his friend DJ Tom Middleton, a future house star, he was soon a fixture on the Cornish Free party scene, where he would splice his sets with his own gorgeously wonky compositions. Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92 was released through Belgian house label R&S and marketed as a compilation. The conceit was that it collected material James had composed all the way back to early adolescence. In fact, most of the compositions were relatively recent. Regardless, the record brimmed with mystery and owed more to the refractory minimalism of Philip Glass and Stockhausen than to house mainstays Frankie Knuckles or 808 State. James's first album would grow in stature across the intervening decades. Its legacy lies in the fact that it proved electronic music could take advantage of a long play format to deliver works of nuance and ambition. In that regard, it paved the way for records by everyone from the Chemical Brothers and Left Field to Burial and Floating Point. As it marks its anniversary, it thus stands as one of the most important records of the 1990s. While the precise release date is lost in time, the consensus is that it was sometime in early February. The thing about Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92 is that it arrived at exactly the right time. An entirely new genre of music. But by 1992 it was beginning to settle, and this sort of music was starting to cross over, says Neil Mason, editor of Electronic Sound, a magazine covering electronic music and culture. There's two records I remember blowing me away at the time. Underworld's Dub No Bass With My Head Man, or one word, and Selected Ambient Works, and they both seem to come out of nowhere, he says. There's an accessibility to both those albums. They're not full of floor-to-floor bangers that dominated the raid scene. Dance music came on a 12-inch, so the idea of an album of the stuff was still quite fresh. Selected Ambient Works 85-92 packed a chaotic and unsettling punch. It opens with the cooing Extal, built around a Mike Oldfield-esque 1986 piece by composer Steve Jeffries, Mary Carew, and Donald Grieg called Atmospheric Vocal. That is followed by Thar, a beautifully spasmodic sliver of minimalism, riding a mutating drum pattern. Elsewhere, compositions such as Ptolemy combine frantic rhythms and halcyon atmospherics. No matter how many times you've listened, there's always something new to discover, and I'm going to re-listen later. It's not about grooves or music to dance to. It's electronic music, and that's not the same as dance music. People do tend to confuse the two things. Just because something's electronic, it doesn't necessarily follow that it's dance music, continues Mason. When he crossed over, Aphex flew in the face of what the common conception of dance music was, as did Underworld. They both make music you can dance to, but you don't have to. Sticking some headphones on and listening is just as good. Aphex Twin didn't invent the ambient genre. Brian Eno, who'd already pioneered it in the 1970s with records such as Ambient One, Music for Airports. But Selected Ambient Works and its 1994 follow-up, Selected Ambient Works Volume 2, pushed on from Eno's meticulous wooziness and broke new ground by tapping into the energy of the clubbing scene. There was little that sounded like either record that came out much prior to them, especially Volume 2. When we listen to them, not only do we hear them, but we hear a Eurotext for so much that followed, says writer, critic and ambient music expert Mark Weidenbaum, who wrote about Selected Ambient Works Volume 2 for Bloomsbury's 33 and a Third series of short books about Landmark Records. They resonate with listeners today because we sense so much of their impact on today's music. Yet for all its historical significance, Selected Ambient Works Parts 1 and 2 are overshadowed slightly. James is today remembered as the demon prince of late 1990s electronica, and that notoriety largely flows from two works of art peripheral to his music. There are the videos Chris Cunningham directed for the singles and Window Licker from 1999. In the former, a man is chased by children wearing unsettling Richard D. James masks. For the latter, Cunningham photoshopped James's bestubbled face onto the body of a model who morphs into a monster. The Chris Cunningham stuff really stuck, didn't it, says Mason. I think there's people who only see Aphex in those terms. Selected ambient words could hardly be further from Come to Daddy. Come to Daddy didn't entirely drop from the clear blue sky. Offstage, James had always had a slightly manic quality, recalls Nicholson, who was working with San Francisco-based skatewear label Anarchic Adjustment when asked to design an amorphous Aphex Twin logo. When I met him, we shared a taste in music, says the graphic artist, introduced to James in the early 1990s via a girlfriend from Cornwall. You could say we were kind of pranksters. We would wind people up with practical jokes. So a lot of the time, if we were with groups of people, we would kind of delight in just being annoying, basically. Just winding people up. I'm going to carry over the rest of his article into the next hour, folks. I'm just going to carry on with our study of the Aphex Twin. Because I obviously I don't want to start this, and because I know the break is just about to start, the break music is just about to start. So go and get yourself a cup of tea, cup of coffee, and we'll continue on with our journey through the music of Richard D. James, the Aphex Twin, after the break. See you in a bit.
You. If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays? For Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law, spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Afternoon and welcome back to the second hour. Oh, good afternoon, good morning rather over there, isn't it? It's afternoon over here. Yeah, good morning and welcome back to the second hour of the Sunday the 3rd of July 2022 edition of Willow's Weekend World. My name is Willow Andreas, and also known as Sari Sunflower in the Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com chat room. And it's just turned 3 o'clock in the afternoon over here in the UK, which means it's just turned 10 o'clock in the morning over on the East Coast, 9 o'clock in the morning Central Time, 8 o'clock in the morning Mountain Time, midday over on the West Coast. In Aussie land, I'm reckoning it's between midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning. And New Zealand, it's about 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning. But wherever you are in the world, I hope that life is being reasonably kind to you and that you're not allowing what's unfolding around the world to impact upon you too much. Don't let it do that, folks. Don't do that. Don't let it do that. Just keep that spark of inner joy ignited. Retain a sense of equilibrium. Step away and look at the bigger picture and connect with nature. Just be gentle to yourselves. And don't surround yourself with fear all the time. It doesn't do you any good. So we're carrying on with the Sunday Morning Geek Out, which of course is dedicated this morning to, is a dedicated focus rather, on Richard D. James, otherwise known as the Aphex Twin, one of the titans of electronica. And we're carrying on with this article, this wonderful article here from The Independent about him. So we'll continue from there where I left off. A case can be made that some of the most engaging British electronic music comes from off the beaten track. Boards of Canada, those titans of psychedelic electronica, are from Moray in Scotland. Orbital hailed from Otford in Kent. And Prodigy were from, were from unglamorous Braintree, Essex. James's hometown of Redruth was, meanwhile, about as far from the centre of the universe as you can get in the early 1990s. I grew up in Cornwall, in Redruth, where Aphex Twin grew up. And I think it's a weird place, says Aram Kent, poet and founder of publisher Broken Sleep Books. I've always had this sort of Bruce Springsteen desire to leave one night and never go back until I left and missed it, continues Kent, co-editor of the recently published You've Got So Many Machines, Richard, an anthology of poems inspired by Aphex Twin. And I think that small town juxtaposition lends itself to creative exploration. I agree with that. Definitely in Cornwall, where the perception is of a sort of Disney-fied county, but really it's a place of deep poverty and trouble. In the 1990s, James cut a singularly enigmatic figure. There were the scary videos and mind-bending live shows, featuring at one point nightmarish dancing teddy bears. And there were the stories, breathlessly recycled in the music press, about his purchase of a Daimler Ferret Mark III armoured scout car. His reputation as the Howard Hughes of British electronica was sealed with the revelation that, from 1997, he lived in the former branch of building of HSBC Bank in Newington Causeway in South London, complete with reinforced walls and functioning vaults. There were rumours that he drove a tank around Redruth, but I never saw it, says Kent. and rumors he lived in a treehouse in Lanna. His aura is one of a puzzle, and that seems to transcend the music. I saw him once, I think, walking a dog in Newquay, maybe, and because it was so difficult to be absolutely certain it was him, I didn't say anything. So there you go, that concludes the article, that particular article. There we go. The next article is from The Guardian, and it's authored by Ben Beaumont Thomas. It was posted up on 7th of August 2018. And it's more of a sort of, more of an exploration, continuing on with an exploration now of the artist himself. And it's headlined Blimps, Runes and Latte Mummies: How Aphex Twin Keeps Fans Guessing. So yeah, this article was written because he had just released his first new music since 2016 at this point, and being preceded by a typically twisted rabbit hole of clues for fans to decipher. You know where you are with pop fandom? Construct homemade banner, queue up outside hotel or TV studio, scream, return home. But if you're an Aphex Twin fan, this seems positively aesthetic in its simplicity. The Cornish producer sends his fans down labyrinthine rabbit holes full of clues and in-jokes. He's just released his first new material since 2016. This is 2018, remember. The high-tempo stuttering electro-groove of T69 Collapse. The first sign of it was the appearance of his rune-like A symbol in London's Elephant and Castle tube station, perhaps a nod to the rumour that he bought up the silvery structure in the middle of the area's roundabout, followed by the same 3D design printed amid the greenery on a wall of a Los Angeles record shop. Then there was an announcement of sorts, a distorted press release promising an EP called Collapse. An enterprising fan has unpicked and transcribed the document, though we're not really any the wiser. It bimbles on about simulated latte mummies and declares the EP a fun water gathering. Aphex spread the twin tails and succeeded in his early car, Frolic Rating 23. There was a hint that new music might come in the middle of the week, and so it proves. The video, with its glitching street scene images and mutating lines of text referring to peanut butter, will send fans off on more decryption missions. This is classic Aphex japery. His previous album, Syro, was heralded via a fluorescent blimp appearing over London, followed by an announcement made on the deep web. And for every stunt, there'll be fans putting in the legwork or money. When he released tens of demos to his SoundCloud page, fans annotated them in a gloriously nerdy Google Doc, pointing out samples of Eazy-E, Joni Mitchell, and the movie Short Circuit, alongside sage observations. Uses the same shaker sound as Girl Boy. And when one of the five copies of lost album Caustic Window emerged, it became one of the most expensive records ever sold after it was bought in an eBay auction by Minecraft creator Marcus Persson for $46,300. Aphex fans clubbed together to buy another copy, raising $67,424. An endeavour organised on We Are The Music Makers, a message board full of Aphex memes and fan-created art. Someone has already made a collapsing GIF version of a 3D Aphex logo that has appeared in recent weeks. The numerous Cornish place names across his back catalogue have even been plotted on Google Maps by We Are The Music Makers users. If surfing at Newquay sounds a bit high-octane, you could perhaps indulge in an Aphex road trip on your Cornish summer holiday. Yeah, sounds about right. I haven't looked at that one yet. I'll have to have a look at it. Explore, I think. So next article is from faroutmagazine.co.uk, authored by Jordan Potter. It was posted up on 13th of March this year. Now, I'm aware from my researching for this particular show that there is the nature of the the relationship between Radiohead and Aphex Twin is interesting. But one certainly has inspired the other. And this is an article about Aphex Twin revealing his thoughts on Radiohead. That is indeed pretty much the title of this article. As mentioned, post up on 13th March this year. So we'll start with it and see what happens, shall we? So Richard D. James, more commonly known as Aphex Twin, is the epitome of experimental music. The Cornish recluse set off in the mid-1980s as a pioneering ambient music producer, following in the footsteps of Brian Eno. His debut album, Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92, released with the Belgian label Apollo in 1992, garnered his first glimpse of critical and popular acclaim. The album collates a number of ambient tracks, which also carry strains of early techno music. Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92 has become one of the most iconic electronic albums of all time, and is seen by most electronic artists as the holy grail of ambient and techno music. James released his most important album at the beginning of the 1990s, a decade where electronic music appeared to follow James's example into the realms of house and techno during the blossoming rave scene. As a pioneer by nature, James looked to further warp the conventions of music with his increasingly experimental music throughout the 90s. In 1993, James signed to the influential label Warp Records and subsequently released his second album, I Care Because You Do, in 1995. The album showed him taking a step into the bizarre with a diverse collection of electronic tracks that even featured a sample of him dragging a chair across the floor in the most popular track on the album, Alberto Balsam. James's second album showed his indisputable talent and also gave us the first experiences of some of his more unlistenable experiments. Yes, I'm referring to Ventolin, the track that will irritate not only you, but also your neighbour's dog. Now, if I'm right remembering, this track is about, well, Ventolin, obviously. Ventolin is what is used, it's one of the inhalers over here. It's salbutamol. Which is used obviously for asthmatic medication, Ventolin. I mean, I've had many of them over the years. And it ostensibly, apparently, whether I remember a conversation with my brother in which he said it was about, if I'm right in remembering, about, because Richard D. James is asthmatic. And I remember my brother playing it to me and asking me if I felt it was an accurate audio representation of what it is like to have an asthma attack. And I just said, no, not at all. not one bit. Basically, all you hear is wheezing. That's about it. But anyway, I digress. Carrying on. So through the remainder of the 1990s, James continued to diversify his sound and released the Richard D. James album in 1996, which was followed by the top 40 singles Come to Daddy from 1997 and Window Licker from 1999. His work refused to stand still, always offering something fresh and a little strange for listeners to feast their ears upon. Towards the end of the decade, Radiohead's Thom Yorke had become somewhat disillusioned with conventional rock music after his group's first three albums. In 1998, following Radiohead's tour in support of their masterpiece OK Computer, Yorke had become exhausted and opted to take some time away from their non-stop lives of touring and recording. During this period, he sought shelter from rock by listening mostly to electronic musics by the likes of Aphex Twin, Autechre, and Squarepusher. His flirtings with experimental electronic music inspired him to create the 2000 experimental electro-infused rock album Kid A, which was followed by Amnesiac in 2001, which was compiled using material from the same recording sessions. Radiohead cited Aphex Twin as one of their key influences following the release of these two albums. But what does the elusive Richard D. James think of them? In an interview with Heiko Hoffman in the early 2000s, James was asked for his opinion on Radiohead and their experimental electro-rock work. "Your music has been hugely influential. One of the more prominent musicians who've said they've been inspired by your records are Radiohead. Did you listen to any of their last two albums, Kid A and Amnesiac? James replied bluntly, I don't like them. I heard maybe 5 or 6 tracks and I thought they sounded really, really cheesy. Cheesy? Asked the surprised interviewer. To which James replied, yeah, really obvious and cheesy. I mean, I'm just comparing it to my favourite music and I think it's terrible compared to that. But compared to all the shit boring R&B tracks, it's probably all right. Compared to those teen punk sort of bands or whatever they're supposed to be called, who think that they are really anarchic and stuff like that, they are probably amazing. If you're only exposed to that kind of stuff, and then Radiohead come along, you'll probably think that they are geniuses. While James's opinions may have upset a few of the diehard Radiohead fans among us, we can find comfort in the fact that James isn't easily pleased and enjoys being contrarian. Elsewhere in the interview, James explained his idiosyncratic taste. I'm quite happy with the state of things at the moment. I like there to be shit music around. I like people to not be informed of what's around. If too many people would listen to what I listen to, I wouldn't like it. I always wanted to be seen as being different. I like to like things that other people don't. If Mertzbo was in the charts, I wouldn't like it anymore. Some people don't want to do what everyone else is doing, and some people do. It's very simple. So there we go. There we go. There's a track here as well that they've included called Freeman. Listen to Freeman, Hardy and Willis, Acid, by Square Pusher and AFX Richard D. James's lesser-known alias. Freeman, Hardy and Willis was a chain of shoe sellers in this country, if I remember, back in the day. Freeman, Hardy and Willis. That takes me back a bit. Cheap shoes they used to sell. So I'll just share those there in both chat rooms. Now the next article, back to The Guardian for this one, authored by Lauren Martin, posted up on the 15th of September 2019, it's a review of an Aphex Twin concert. So I thought, well, I've never been to one. And I wanted to provide an overall feel for what the Aphex Twin experience is like. So I thought, well, let's have a read of this review of this concert, which is headlined, Aphex Twin Review, Wild Lights, Jungle Buzzsaw and a Boo for Boris. Well, that's an interesting set. Ooh. So it's at Printworks London. Okay. When Printworks opened to much hurrah 2 years ago, it did so, well, 2 years ago back in, so it's 2019, so 2017 now. It did so during a run of venue closures in London. It's aesthetically impressive and has quickly become one of the best venues for large-scale electronic events, and so is ripe for an Aphex Twin brain tickle, even if free earplugs, sadly, aren't on offer tonight. Although the musician has never relied on album cycles to draw in new audiences, it is striking how young the audience winding through Printworks is. As well as releasing around a dozen EPs in the past decade on his own label, Reflex and Warp, there was mass excitement about Richard David James's return as an album artist in 2014, with the Grammy Award-winning Syro, and the memorable flight of a neon green blimp bearing the Aphex Twin logo over London. Along with the weight of his back catalogue and mythical status, what makes shows such as these sell out in minutes is Aphex Twin's love of spectacle and keen support for new electronic artists. The former is a perfect fit for this, the Red Bull Music Festival's high concept and budget. In terms of the latter, he's viewed as a switched-on father figure to younger artists and fans, his hybrid set blending new club tracks with live modular jams, his own music, and ripe selections of 90s UK hardcore. The support acts, excuse me, sorry about this. The support acts, Italian electronic minimalist Caterina Barbieri, Ugandan percussion group Nihiloxica, and Manchester electro producer and DJ Afro Deutscher, are all excellent, but Nihiloxica stand out. Part of experimental Kampala label Nyege and Nyege Tapes, the group blends Bugandan drumming with a kit player, analog synthesizers, and multi-played vocalizations to twisted effect. When it goes quiet for Aphex Twin, the long concrete room floods with an intense light. The show has been custom-built with collaborator Weirdcore. 306 motorized LED screens are staggered on stage and above heads and move throughout the performance. Cameras film the crowd and images of dancers are digitally manipulated so that logos and manic depictions of Aphex Twin appear on their projected images. It's a humour that wavers between caustic critique and outright silliness. Cheers ring out for skittering flashes of British celebrities as reality TV stars such as Amber and Greg from Love Island are spliced into technicolour flashes of the Queen, Piers Morgan and Boris Johnson, whose image gets a loud boo. The lasers are, bluntly, crazy, an impressive sensory assault. It's unabashed fun, strangers craning their necks and grinning at each other. Musically, Aphex Twin is on top form, manoeuvring at breakneck speed through genre-melting sounds. Heaving polyrhythmic techno tracks fold into industrial electro pumpers, thundering piano loops and buzzsaw jungle breaks. There are flashes of the past, the future sounds of London's Pulse State, the Octagon Man's Freer Than Free, and D-Shake's techno trance, Paradise Is Now, capture that 90s UK hardcore euphoria, and nods to the future, with Egyptian producer Zuli's Trigger Finger and HVL's Sallow Myth. For Aphex Twin's own music, there's the hiss and funk of 2017's TI 6.5 Madma with Nastya 5.2 and aquatic bleeps of 2015's Unmill 2501. Perhaps the sweetest moment comes in the latter movements of the set. After a caustic hardcore breakdown, a wash of ambience. Stone in Focus from 1994 Selected Ambient Works Volume 2. As everyone takes a breath, a father and son nearby nod at each other knowingly. All told, a faultless performance from a peerless artist. So there we go. I'll just share that one there in the chat room as well. I should just share those in both. So the next article is from factmag.com, authored by Chris Kelly and John Twells. I'm not sure when it was posted up, but I saw this and it's sort of, he's a bit of an unusual person, is Richard D. James. And this is headlined Aphex Twin, 10 Strange Myths and the Truth Behind Them. There are a few artists with as many strange urban legends around them as Aphex Twin. But which myths are real, which ones are false, and where did they come from? Here's everything you need to know according to this article. It may well be, I have no idea, but let's just see, shall we? So in delving through the discography of Richard D. James to come up with the top Aphex Twin tracks of all time, the fact staff revisited old favourites, unearthed forgotten treasures, and, like the video for Come to Daddy, ran around causing mayhem as if James's face was our own. But spending that much time in the head of such a gifted, maddening and singular artist will have its side effects, like not being able to decipher which parts of James's self and fan-created mythology are true. Is Aphex Twin some sort of warped Dr. Seuss character, a former child prodigy who lives in a bank and drives a tank, pulling melodies and rhythms from lucid dreams, or an impish musician who gets his kicks by colouring outside of the lines and taking the piss out of the press? Here are 10 of the more persistent tall tales about the twin, and in the immortal words of a Fox News channel, we report, you decide. Oh, excuse me. Ow. Okay, that's a bit better. Before he was Aphex Twin, he was a prodigy. The title of Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92 suggests that the earliest Aphex Twin material was first drafted when Richard James was just 14 years old. Considering the album's legendary status and continued influence over electronic music, that might be a tough pill to swallow. But Benjamin Middleton, brother of Tom, claims that he saw James producing music in his Cornwall bedroom at age 12. Plus, there are countless stories of his building circuits and synthesizers from scratch during his teens, which he would use at his early DJ gigs. In an age where easy access to sequencing and recording software has taken the search for the next big thing into secondary schools, this claim might not seem as outrageous as it did during the Aphex Twin heyday, but if true, it's impressive nonetheless. I have to say, looking at the overall, well, I was saying earlier on, I mean, there's a lot of similarities between him and Liam Howlett and Vangelis. In that regard, it's I believe it. Metal Machine music. James has always demonstrated an unparalleled gift for squeezing sounds and noise out of synthetics, and it may be a talent that he's had from a young age. In a 2001 interview, he claimed that at age 11, he won £50 in a competition for writing a program that made sound on the ZX81. An early home computer without external sound. I played around with machine code and found some codes that retuned the TV signal so that it made this really weird noise when you turned the volume up, he said. Unfortunately for the Aphex Twin legend, intrepid blogger Richard Lane tracked down what he believes to be the winning entry in the competition by investigating scans of decades-old computer magazines. According to Lane, the author of the program was not a pre-teenage James, but Leamington Spa's Gary N. Owen, who was awarded not £50, but £6 for his entry. Some might believe this to be James's first anagram-based pseudonym, Angry Owner, Yearn Wrong, but we prefer to use Occam's Razor when debunking this one. The significance of the Aphex Twin. While it was initially speculated that Tom Middleton, who co-produced early Aphex track On Trance to Exit, under the name Schizophrenia, was the twin in Aphex Twin, the moniker allegedly has a more personal and devastating origin. James has maintained that his brother, 3 years older and also named Richard, was stillborn. My mum was so upset about it when he died that she kept his name on but forgot about him, thinking, the next boy I have, that'll be him, James said in a 1996 interview. So I sort of took his place as if he didn't exist. A photo purporting to be his brother's gravestone, allegedly taken at an unknown location. Well, there's a photograph, apparently, which is because they lived in Canada at the time, was used as a cover for the Girl Boy EP, but the entire tale has such an air of macabre humour that it could be as easily be fiction. I must be lucid dreaming. Lucid dreaming is the act of being aware of and controlling your dreams. And it's a technique James claims to be responsible for 80% of the tracks of Selected Ambient Works Volume 2. In a 1994 interview, he explained, I go to sleep, dream I'm in my studio with imaginary bits of gear and do a track. Then I wake myself up and recreate it. I can do this in about 20 minutes. He went on to say that he realised he had the ability when he was about 7, but it said it took 6 months of practice to actually start remembering melodies. James mentioned the technique in a number of interviews at the time, notably contributing to a now notorious 1995 feature in The Wire. But whether it's absolute cobblers or not is difficult to prove. The technique itself is somewhat established, but whether he really applied it to the album itself is another thing altogether. It sounds feasible enough listening to the tracks like Domino and Grey Stripe, but when you read his comments in Loaded magazine, yeah, I used to go to bed just to write songs, but now I just sleep and occasionally wake up with a new one by mistake. At the moment, I'm getting into inventing things in my sleep instead. There's a sense that there's more than just a whiff of bullshit. Sandpaper and food processors. In 1994, James was invited to play at London club Disobey, and since he was a regular, I'd go down there to see all the weird and wonderful acts they'd have on, he says. He figured he'd take them up on the offer, even though he couldn't really play any records. Instead of spinning wax, he just played some sandpaper, and predictably enough, people loved it. Things got more interesting when he performed the same set in New York City at Blast's first showcase and added a food mixer to set up. I just mixed some sandpaper together for a bit and then played a food mixer and threw it at someone, he says in the 1997 interview. I hit the bloke on the head and I thought I would get sued for that, but he wanted me to sign it afterward. He said I would keep this food mixer forever. Apparently there's still enough interest in this legendary set to garner a massive $232.50 bid on eBay for a piece of sandpaper stamped with an Aphex Twin logo, which may or may not even be official. Rumours that it was pressed in 1994, unconfirmed. There's one born every minute, clearly. He bought a tank. It's easy to spot where this rumour came from. Richard D. James doesn't exactly own a tank, but he owns something very similar. A Daimler Ferret Mark III armoured scout car, to be exact. Armed with a mounted machine gun and a welded steel body, it's easy to see how it was confused for a tank, and James has relished telling reporters about it all over the years. In one particular 1995 piece for Details magazine, James explains his fascination with the vehicle, noting that it pisses all over virtual reality or any computer game I've ever played. Clocking in at over £9,500 and larger than an ice cream truck, it's a big toy that, according to James, is harder to control than the mixing board in his studio. James does admit, though, that after getting to grips with its problematic steering, it can be a pretty safe place to hide. It's like a womb with a gun. And lived in a bank. James bought a now-demolished former bank in Elephant and Castle opposite Ministry of Sound some time around the recording of the Come to Daddy EP and figured that its four-foot-thick walls would be good sound dampeners as well as a natural deterrent for burglars. There's the fact that he wanted the karma of living in a place where money comes in all the time, which doesn't make any sense at all. Still, telling people that he lives in a bank vault has been a long-term weirdo calling card for James, so its purpose has probably been well served. Contrary to popular opinion, however, the building in question is not the odd box-like structure in the middle of the Elephant and Castle roundabout. That building is in fact the Michael Faraday Memorial, which houses the London Underground Electrical Substation. And we are the music makers. It's next, so James has made it pretty clear over the years that his custom gear has been pretty important to his singular sound. But it seems to have been down to necessity rather than a specific desire to make something customised. Talking to Junglist in 1996, he said, "When I bought my first synthesizer, I really didn't like it. I thought it was a piece of shit, and I really didn't have any money to buy anything better, so I had to go about tweaking it. I just started with basic alterations, but as the years went by, the alterations got bigger and bigger." By the time we get to 1997, James had moved on, saying he felt as if he was just someone who is effing around in a bedroom on the computer, but did say he was totally into the idea of making my own programs for my own music, which does suggest a similar creative urge, regardless of the exact platform. Mixes for cash. Okay, I admit that sometimes I don't put any work into remixing at all. From a man who flippantly named a collection of remixes 26 mixes for cash, the statement isn't surprising. What is surprising is the extremes to which James would allegedly take this operating principle. As legend holds, he was commissioned to remix alt-rockers The Lemonheads, but when the courier came for the tape, he had nothing to turn in. He either didn't listen to the original or couldn't be bothered to do their track because it was so shit. Instead, he grabbed an old track, handed it over, and was paid $4,000 for his work. Strangely, they never released it, he told Loaded, which makes confirming this one particularly difficult. They should have been honoured, I reckon. It would have sounded better than any rubbish song they wrote. Oh, excuse me, I'm just scratching my head. Aphex Twin is playing at my house. Okay. Richard James is nothing if not a populist. In a 2001 interview, he claimed that no venue or event was too small for an Aphex Twin performance, provided it was in London and he had the time. Yeah, I played in people's houses. Last month I got an email from a guy who said my grandma died and she left me lots of money. He thought, that sounds cool, and I drove to the place with a huge tour bus. Those are my favourite gigs, a mixture of friends and people from the street, he continued. Soon I'm going to play at a wedding, and just recently a girl asked me if I could play Gabba at her party because she finished her exams in History of Art. I said, yeah, definitely. As long as it's in London and I've got time for stuff like that, I like doing it. Imagine Girl Boy Song is the first dance at your wedding with RDJ behind the decks. I have to say, that sounds rather fun. Rather fun indeed. Having an Aphex Twin gig in your front room. So we're going to conclude now. If there's any time for anything in the poetry corner, I'll read it. But I'm not going to promise at this point. I'm just absolutely thrilled that I've gotten through the show. Returning to The Guardian for this one. And it's authored by Geeta Dayal. It was posted up on the 28th of February 2019. And it's a ranking of his best songs, put simply. And it was written about the time of the 25th anniversary of the release of the Selected Ambient Works Volume 2. And she was taking a look back at his back catalogue. So we'll start with number 20, which is Window Licker from 1999. So this epic glitch fest sounds just as weird now as it did two decades ago. Chris Cunningham's bizarre music video, complete with a Michael Jackson-style dance number, a foul-mouthed extended director's version, and a small army of women who all have Richard D. James's face, will continue to spawn nightmares for years to come. Number 19 is Avril 14 from 2001. This plaintive piano ballad from the unjustly maligned Drux album has had a long half-life in popular culture, appearing in everything from films by Sofia Coppola, It's in Marie Antoinette, and Spike Jones, the film is her, to being sampled by Kanye West for Blame Game on My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. Number 18 is AFX. It was actually AFX Klopp Job from 2004. Klopp Job is an inviting slab of squiggly melodic electro from the 2005 Analord series of 11, 12-inch singles. It ping-pongs back and forth from happy-go-lucky to dark and dystopian. Number 17 is Polynomial C from 1992. This impressive early track, released in 1992 and added to the 1994's Classics compilation, ably splits the difference between the boundless deep spaces of Detroit techno and the propulsive power of the breakbeat. Number 16 is, oh good grief, Cat 000... Cat 00897AA1, fluted, from 1993. Okay. A delicate melody floats over effervescent beats and a white noise snare in this captivating early track from the third volume of Aphex fan favourite analog Bubble Bar series. Originally packaged in bubble wrap with no liner notes and a sticker reading 66% more bubbles, Cat 00897AA1, fluted, is Aphex at his most playful. Number 15 is On, from 1993. Sparkling synthesized melodies pair with stuttering, almost ungainly beats, showing off Aphex's endless capacity for creating rhythmic and textural contrast. The music video was directed by Jarvis Cocker, who created a stop-motion mashup of Aphex imagery and also shot a video for fellow Warp Stalwart LFO. Number 14 is Bucephalus Bouncing Ball. Okay. 1997. So this dazzling cascade of ricocheting rhythms shows off Aphex's considerable technical skill and range as a producer. According to Autechra's Sean Booth, it's the response of a similarly trippy track Drain. The surprise melody that surfaces inside the controlled chaos is an added bonus. Number 13 is Helios Fan from 1992. Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92 is packed full of classics. Pretty much any track from this album could appear here, from Pulse Width to Ptolemy to We Are the Music Makers. But the stately, expansive Helios Fan is a particular high point. Number 12 is Star from 1992. A lot of the great 90s electronic music sounded like it was playing underwater. from the deep, dubby undertow of Berlin's basic channel to hugely influential Detroit pioneers Drexia and disorienting ambient house of the Orb. In Thar, Aphex's beats are heavily cloaked in murk, and the melody sounds partially submerged, slowly surfacing as the track progresses. Number 11 is Girl Boy Song from 1996. This unlikely marriage of gracefully plucked strings and frenzied programmed beats is one of Aphex's best-loved tunes. The clashing timbres and styles could easily sound discordant, but here they blend together seamlessly. Number 10 is Didgeridoo from 1992. A disorienting acid house banger that doubles as a kind of satire on hippie ravers, a friend asked Aphex to write it to clear their Cornish beach parties once dawn broke. Unlike most hippie Cornish beach parties, Didgeridoo contains no actual didgeridoo. Those cavernous woody tones were all synthesized. Number 9 is Stone in Focus from 1994. This stirring, slow-burning anthem appeared on the vinyl and cassette versions of Selected Ambient Works Volume 2, but was strangely left off the CD version. On YouTube, the tune lives on, with millions of views and thousands of comments discussing everything from the vastness of the universe to monoliths and existential despair. Number 8 is Alberto Balsam, which is name of a shampoo over here, from 1995. Another track that shows off Aphex Twin's flair for writing a melody that sticks hard to the brain pan. Alberto Balsam, named after the shampoo. The song also includes the sound of Aphex cutting his hair, ambles along at a genial pace. You can actually click your fingers to this one. Number 7 is Polygon Window Quoth from 1993. Quoth. Like most of the songs Aphex released under his Polygon Window moniker, this is a straight-up hard techno banger propelled by clattering industrial rhythms and enough propulsive force to break through a brick wall. Number 6 is Blue Calcs from 1994. So much of a Selected Ambient Works Volume 2 was inspired by lucid dreaming, according to interviews Aphex gave at the time. Blue Calcs is one of the dreamiest tracks on the double album, an airy melody underpinned by a gentle rhythm that could lull even the most defiant insomniac to sleep. Number 5 is Untitled, Track 1, Disc 1 from 1994. In the unforgettable opener to Selected Ambient Works Volume 2, known by fans as Cliffs, a childlike voice loops over a gentle melody. It is soothing and slightly unsettling at the same time, traversing the same hallucinatory memory scape that would be mined by fellow electronic explorers such as Boards of Canada. Number 4 is Agesopolis from 1992. Agesopolis, from Selected Ambient Works 85 to 92, has a grand cinematic sweep. Tightly arranged with an acute sense of pacing and drama, it shows Aphex's considerable talent as a songwriter as well as a producer. Into the top three now. Number 3 is Untitled, Track 3, Disc 1 from 1994. Codenamed Rhubarb by fans, this wistful melody from Selected Ambient Works Volume 2 repeats and slowly builds, moving gently outwards like ripples of water in a lake. The deceptively simple ambient track somehow conjures powerful images. Many listeners report feeling deep waves of nostalgia. Number 2 is US from 1997. This gorgeous, somber closing track came as a surprise on the mostly dark and frenetic Come to Daddy EP. The only problem is that it clocks in at just under 3 minutes. It's not nearly long enough. Number 1 is Aphex Analog Bubble Bath from 1991. So Aphex is known for his deviant humour and aggressively disorientating arrangements, but Analog Bubble Bath is one of those timeless tracks that convey incredible emotional depth, expressing multiple feelings in perfect synchrony. It's melancholy and uplifting, moody and hopeful, ecstatic and forlorn, all at the same time. A radiant anthem with a softer side, it still stands as a gold standard for electronic music, nearly 30 years after its initial release. yeah, I'm going to have to revisit a few of these, I think. Been a while. It's been too long. I'm going to reacquaint myself with the Aphex Twin. I love listening to. Excuse me, I've just got to scratch my head a minute. Oh, yeah. Oh, that feels a bit better. So, yeah. If you haven't listened to the Aphex Twin, I recommend it, folks. It's worthwhile. It's worthwhile. So I do have time for something from the Poetry Corner. And I haven't got anything lined up particularly. So I'm just going to go to interestingliterature.com and just see where I go with it. See what we've got. I suppose I could read this one, which is 10 of the best ghost stories of M.R. James, given that we've just talked about Richard D. James. I suppose I could do that. No relation, but shall we do that? We've got time for this one? Let's have a look. I'm sure we have. I don't know. Yeah, let's give it a go. Probably fit this in about 8 minutes. Let's give it a go. Yeah, because we had Richard D. James, so here's 10 of the best ghost stories of M.R. James. As I say, no relation, but I just, yeah, why not? Let's have a look at this one, shall we? So this is 10 of the best ghost stories of M.R. James on Interesting Literature, posted up last month. If there is a Shakespeare of the ghost stories, it's surely Montague Rhodes James, 1862 to 1936, better known to legions of ghost story readers as M.R. James. No other writer of the ghost story has managed to summon the haunting aspects of the distant past quite so effectively and unnervingly as James. Indeed, he is often named as the founder of the antiquarian ghost story for his keen perception that objects from centuries ago can harbour weird and unsettling associations for us. As is often the case with master storytellers, James began composing his ghost stories for a close circle of friends and colleagues at the University of Cambridge, where James worked as a medievalist scholar, as provost of King's College, and eventually as vice-chancellor of the whole university. He would read them out every year on Christmas Eve before they were eventually published in a number of collections. But what are the very best M.R. James ghost stories? So here we go. So let's introduce 10 of his greatest and say a little about why they are worth reading. And we start with number 1, which is Lost Hearts. This was only the second ghost story James wrote, but it remains one of his very best, as well as one of his most unsettling. It's unusual in having not a donnish scholar or collector as its protagonist, a James staple, but a young orphan boy, Stephen, who is sent to stay with his cousin, an aging recluse named Mr. Abney. Stephen starts to see strange visions around the house, visions of other children whose hearts are missing, and Mr. Abney is in pursuit of the secret to eternal life. Number 2 is A View from a Hill. Although not as famous as some of the other stories on this list, A View from a Hill is, for our money, one of James's best. It's about an antiquarian named Fanshawe who goes to stay with his friend, a country squire. Fanshawe borrows a pair of old binoculars from his friend when they go exploring together. Through these binoculars, Fanshawe can see into the past, revealing an old abbey and church which were demolished centuries ago, and a gallows where criminals were hanged. M.R. James's ghost stories are a good example of how genuine fear in the reader is built up through a gradual accumulation of details. Suggestion, as much as the big reveal. And the moment when Fanshawe first sees a substantial abbey, only to be told by his friend that it's little more than a ruin, is one of the finest moments in James's fiction. Number 3 is A Warning to the Curious. One of James's most perennially popular stories, A Warning to the Curious, focuses on a young archaeologist named Paxton, who hears about a legend concerning 3 holy crowns, one of which remains buried somewhere on the southeast coast of England. Paxton locates the crown, digs it up, and, well, let's just say he quickly comes to realise that he should have let it rest. The moment when Paxton and the narrator learn that there was a third person, a ghostly presence, following them, is another standout moment in James's fiction. Number 4 is number 13. A man goes to stay in an inn in Denmark. His room is number 12, and strange things soon start to happen while he's in there. Furniture disappears, and the dimensions of the room appear to shrink. Noise can be heard from next door, but he's told there is no room number 13. When he knocks at number 14, the room next door, he learns that the occupant thought he was the one making the noise. So what happened to the mysterious number 13? It was perhaps inevitable for a ghost story writer to explore our cultural superstition of surrounding this unlucky number, and many street planners and hotel owners don't have a room number 13 because of its negative connotations. But perhaps no writer has tapped into those fears more successfully than James does here. Number 5 is Oh Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad. Perhaps the most quintessentially Jamesian story of them all, this one was memorably adapted by the late Jonathan Miller in the 1960s, with Michael Horden turning in a brilliantly understated performance. Whoever said that a white sheet couldn't make a convincing and truly terrifying ghost needs to watch Miller's adaptation and read James's story. The tale, which is named after a 1793 poem of the same name by Robert Burns, concerns Parkins, a Cambridge professor who is on holiday on the Suffolk coast. The Jamesian object which triggers an outbreak of haunting in this story is a bronze whistle, which the protagonist stumbles upon while investigating a preceptory that belonged to the Knights Templar. You might not need us to tell you that Parkins will wish he had never disturbed that whistle, much less blown on it. Number 6 is The Ash Tree, so severe arachnophobes may wish to skip this story because of its ending, but it's a classic James story, so it is well worth reading. Witchcraft is the main subject of his James tale, which takes us back to 1690 in a witch trial. A landowner ensures a local woman is condemned as a witch and subsequently executed, but the same landowner dies shortly afterwards in mysterious circumstances. Half a century later, the landowner's grandson takes up residence in the same house and discovers the ash tree in the grounds of the estate is causing problems. Is this tree somehow connected to the events of 50 years earlier? Number 7 is The Treasure of Abbot Thomas, so in M.R. James's ghost stories, objects are usually linked between the present and some horrifying past. And in this story, a scholar of medieval history, so far so quintessential James, recounts how he found a series of clues which led him to a hidden treasure, gold which belonged to an abbot. But if there's one moral in the M.R. James universe, it's that you should never disturb concealed treasure, and if you do, you should promptly put it back. Number 8 is The Tractate Myth. The university librarian is tasked with locating a tractate, a kind of treatise or essay, in the library. A mysterious figure, a clergyman dressed in black and shrouded in cobwebs, also appears in search of a document, which it transpires contains a key piece of evidence regarding the inheritance of a family estate. This is a slightly unusual James story in that it ends happily, not to give away too many spoilers, with the announcement of a marriage, though it doesn't end happily for all parties. Number 9 is The Stalls of Barchester Cathedral. An archdeacon dies in mysterious circumstances and his replacement, an ambitious man named Haynes, settles into the role. But he soon begins to be haunted by strange carved figures in the stalls of Barchester Cathedral. Did Haynes have something to do with the death of his predecessor? The narrator thinks so. And finally is The Mezzotint. So by now it should be apparent that M.R. James developed a clear formula for his ghost stories, which usually runs bachelor who is either a scholar or collector of antiquities, or something history related comes into possession of an object from the past and then wishes he hadn't. And this story, the final pick in this selection of James's best ghost stories, largely conforms to this pattern. The protagonist is a Mr. Williams, who works as a curator of a university art museum, is sent a mezzotint, a black and white print or engraving showing his house. But the print appears to change subtly each time it is looked at, with the position of the moon altering and, more unsettlingly, a strange figure appearing in the picture. So anyway, folks, we're coming up to the top of the hour now, so don't know if I'm going to have the time to tell you what's happening on both studios throughout today, but I can tell you now that coming up after me on this very studio is the lovely Lizzie with Spirit Talk with Lizzie, and over the other side of the studio wall is the station's GM AMAB painter with A Mad Look at Reality, and I'll be back with you tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on Studio A with Willow's World. So you all take care. You have a lovely Sunday. See you tomorrow. Take care.
Listening to Revolution Radio. back in.
There's still men out there.
God damn.
When I go home, people ask me, "Hey, Hoot, why do you do it, man? Why? Some kind of war junkie?" I won't say a goddamn word. Why? They won't understand. They won't understand why we do it. They won't understand it's about the men next to you. And that's it. That's all it is.
Revolution Radio. FreedomSlips.com. Number one listener supported radio. The printing press for freedom at a time when freedom is needed the most.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption.